what about AI is on security professionals' minds, and how exactly are we defending soft targets? Welcome to another episode of the Security Management Highlights podcast from ASIS International. Every month, we focus on the trends and topics the world needs to know about your world of keeping information and people safe. I'm your host, Brendan Howard, and today we speak to Mark Mullison about the European Union's new AI Act and its possible effects on the security world. And we talk with Jenny Hesterman, who walks us through some big picture issues with soft targets and shares some less expensive tactics to use to get started when the C-suite complains about resources. Oh, and special thanks to BeamUp for sponsoring this episode. Their VP of Customer Delivery, David Harris, will show up later to talk more AI-enabled security data. But first, Mark Mullison, Chief Technology Officer at international security company Allied Universal. Mark shares his thoughts on where AI pops up internally and externally with customers at his company after he tells us, or answers the question, hey, is it a good thing the EU has passed this new AI Act with recommendations and regulations for the world?
Well, I think there are certainly some implications that come along with the EU AI Act. I mean, it's a very thorough, comprehensive, broad-ranging piece of legislation, and the EU is the first to the table with legislation that regulates AI. I think everybody who's serious about AI, working in AI, or a serious user of AI, expects, if not welcomes, more regulation, right? The impact, the power of AI to do very good things and also to do bad things is real. And so, as I said, I think people certainly are at least expecting legislation. Now, the devil's in the details. We're going to have to see things play out a little bit. But the EU AI Act certainly gives, is the first big piece of legislation that's going to drive change.
In my skimming of the AI Act, it looked like there was some attention paid to, here are applications of AI that are low risk, and we're really making these recommendations, but they're not mandatory. You should think about this. You're in a low risk application of AI, but then there are high risk application and obvious critical infrastructure things. They said, you will have to follow these things over time. Where overall does the security that kind of Allied Universal does around the world, how do they fall? Is your applications of AI, are they in the low risk recommendation category or the high risk? Yes, you're going to need to follow this.
Yeah, well, it's a great question. So we've got applications of AI, both that are used to directly service customers. And then we also use AI ourselves internally to we really focus on human-centric AI. There are a lot of people who see a real competition between people and machines, and we really think that's a false choice. We really think the best outcomes are going to come to those who make those things cooperate. So in other words, world-class technology, in this case, including great applications of AI and world-class, well-trained people who can do things, certain things, much better than machines will ever be able to. And so for us, it's all about the magic of making those cooperate together to deliver a better outcome. So to your question specifically, how will the EU AI Act impact either of those classes of use cases? The fact is that most of the applications of AI in directly delivering security are fairly limited and fairly low risk. Now, some of them are very advanced. You've got certain data analytics that's being applied to video surveillance, for instance, to identify emotion or to identify specific people or to identify categories or classes of people. And those are either prohibited altogether or identified as high risk under the EU AI Act. I guess the good news is that that there isn't a lot of that out there now. Governments are doing that, although they've got some exemptions under the AI Act. And there are certainly some, very advanced, high security sorts of applications for that, but it's pretty limited. And so I think that the EU AI Act in that regard is probably going to serve to guide future development more so than to, create issues or trouble for anything that's solutions that are fielded today. But it certainly is a consideration for developers of that sort of technology. You really do have to look at, you could be applying exactly the same modeling techniques and building a model. And if that model produces one sort of thing, it's high risk or prohibited. And if it produces another sort of thing, it's not at all. And so it really is about looking at the application.
Could you give maybe one example of something you're using AI for with your customers and something you're using it for internal processes?
Yeah, well, it's not generative AI, but the first AI use case that we fielded was delivered through a product we call Helius. And Helius will be familiar to many of the listeners in the sense that it started and its main use cases are to provide mobile guarding tech services. So, you know, tours, incident management, activity reports, this sort of thing. So the Helius mobile device has become a virtual coach for the guard force to make sure they're doing not only the normal post orders, everything they're supposed to be doing, but they're actioning these AI-driven prescriptions to drive better outcomes. And you know, that would be a great example. That is really our first customer-facing use of AI. Now,
let me ask about that. Where would Helius run into issues? You mentioned, oh, there are certain things that are prohibited by the EU AI Act. What certain things do you have to be sure not to experiment with in gathering this data, analyzing it, and returning it? Or is there anything that falls into, oh, we don't really do that, or we would think twice before we did that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And the answer to that is nothing that Helius does today would be considered high risk at all. Again, high risk comes when you're making I'm paraphrasing, and folks will have to consult their own lawyers. And, you know, over time, this will become, we'll develop our industry shared knowledge of what the impacts of the EU AI Act are. But, you know, my reading of it is that really, in general terms, it's when you are using AI to make a decision that impacts an individual. This is when they really want some governance over that, which, you know, fundamentally, it's very difficult to argue with that. I mean, who wants a machine, you know, in control of people's lives? Nobody. And so, you know, the fundamental sort of high level logic of that is very difficult to argue with. I think it makes all the sense in the world. The questions that are out there is what are going to be the impacts and how is this going to play out? But to bring that back to your question directly, Helius isn't making any decisions about individuals, right? Helius would be doing things like, I mean, it sees much deeper than this, but a great example would be, you know, let's say that we're seeing a lot of trips and falls in the loading dock on Friday afternoons. Helius is going to recommend that the guard force inspect the loading dock for trip and slip hazards midday in order to try to avoid, you know, those slips and falls that are happening or trips and falls that are happening in the loading dock. So we know it works, but not targeting any individual, not making any decision about, oh, this person, you know, not looking at somebody's face and saying, oh, they look agitated, go ask them 10 questions and make sure they're where they need to be. We're not doing that.
Internally, what is something you can either see AI being used or it's being used today?
Well, we right now are using in North America. We don't do this in Europe yet, but the plan is to roll this worldwide. But in North America, since it went live in March 2020, just as COVID was hitting, we went live with a solution we call AU Hire Smart. And AU Hire Smart, we use AI to help to screen and sort through and sift and match job applicants to positions. In North America, we get 50,000 job applicants a week. And so to be able to give a great experience to those applicants, meaning sort through those applications quickly and make sure we're responsive and people get answers quickly and are interacted with quickly, we use AI to help with that. And so we have a chatbot that we've named Sam, who immediately after somebody applies for something, Sam engages with the applicant and starts asking some pre-qualification questions about, you know, the hours they'd like to work and, do they have some of the basic requirements for the job, and either passes them through on the job they applied for or helps to match them to another thing. And the model makes predictions about what sort of fit this person's going to be for a job. And that's sort of the fast track. Now, we are not letting AI make our hiring decisions for us. That's not what we're doing. But we do use AI to help to screen and more quickly match candidates. So we're not quite sure if that falls under EU AI regs or not, but it is in the hiring process. And so it's something that, you know, we look at very carefully. For instance, we evaluate that model every 6 months to make sure that the model's not making, you know, decisions that it shouldn't, right? Having unintended adverse impact on certain classes of people, for instance. And so we monitor that very carefully, which is a big part of using AI. The positive side is that if you get it right, you know your model's making good decisions. Well, a good example of another internal use case of AI We've built an AI called Lisa, and that stands for our Live Interactive Support AI. And Lisa's awesome. She's available 24/7, both to security professionals and to operators, to help with all sorts of things. Well, one of the things Lisa does is she helps security professionals resolve payroll discrepancies. So we work very hard to pay our people right, and almost always we do. But sometimes with over 800,000 people around the world, some mistakes will happen and somebody's paycheck won't be right. Well, if that happens, we want to fix that super fast. And what Lisa allows our security professionals to do is if they get home at 10 o'clock from being out for the night or get off their shift if they're working later in the day and they look at their paycheck and say, oh, you know, it's wrong, they can get online and tell Lisa exactly what's wrong. Lisa will process that, let them help them to make sure that it's not something with, you know, their understanding of the system. Oh, that'll be next week's paycheck. You didn't get shorted, you know, payroll ends at this time or whatever. So helps with those misunderstandings. But then when there's a problem, puts it right to the manager. It'll be in the manager's inbox, all nicely packaged up the next morning. The manager clicks OK and it'll get processed for payment. It'll be in their account the next day.
So Allied Universal is using AI not just for security, but for HR issues too. Their guiding light, it sounds like, is letting AI gather cumulative data, but not letting AI figuratively pull the trigger on any decision about any one individual. Okay, so now David Harris, VP Customer Delivery at BeamUp. He's also thinking about AI a lot these days. BeamUp is a software as a service intelligence platform that provides enterprise organizations with full facility observability and generative solutions for strategic data-driven decision making. Harris himself has got more than 30 years experience in law enforcement and as an executive, and has overseen regional security operations in Asia, Africa, and Europe, and was the former managing director of physical security globally for Barclays Bank. So, we're all hearing about AI and security. We just talked about it. Are we there yet?
Well, I don't actually think that AI has been leveraged anywhere near its full potential in physical security. It is a contentious topic because a lot of what you read is about the threat of AI as opposed to the opportunity of AI. And if you look at the opportunity of AI in physical security, it is predominantly focused on CCTV analytics, enabling facial recognition or number plate recognition or something like that. But that has its limitation purely because of the legal ramifications of things like GDPR. So where has AI really been leveraged? It hasn't, not in physical security. And if you think about it logically, in a physical security environment, there are huge, vast amounts of data generated within physical security. That can come from your access card transaction data or from your alarm system. It can come from your assets register and your security cameras or your security incidents, your guarding patrols and guarding deployments. There's vast amounts of data being generated, but all of that data is siloed. It's siloed in different systems, which means it's very difficult to access for an individual. And even if those individuals could access the data, there is so much of it, it would be both time and cost prohibitive to analyze that data using traditional human-based methods. Utilizing AI really thrives on vast volumes of data and enables you to understand what's happening within the data, the trends and the anomalies and the things that really are of importance to you, that brings it to your attention and enables you to focus where you need to be focusing your attention or your resources or your budget.
Okay, so what does BeamUp do with all that? Are we talking about a dashboard that puts together and analyzes all this raw physical security data?
So it's exactly that. We represent data in two different formats. The data is really seen as observable data, charts and graphs, and we generate insights. And so we do not use, let me make it really clear, we do not use ChatGPT.
Okay.
But ChatGPT is a generative AI, and it produces something based on data. We have the same capability to produce insights, scripted insights that come from the machine learning, that gives clients insights as to what is exactly is happening within their organization and within their facilities. So let me just give you an example of that. So let's take an organization that does have 50 buildings. And every day in every one of those buildings, there are 100 access denied events. Somebody presents an access credential to a reader of some sort, and it goes, access denied. Now that happens 100 times a day in every facility. Every day, that is 5,000 access denied events. Every month, that is 150,000 access denied events. Who is currently analyzing that data? I would say absolutely no one. Now, that's okay if 99.9% of those access denied events are non-malicious, but that still leaves 150 events per month for this organization where there's potential malicious intent from that access denied event. Machine learning can bring this to your attention. Not only can it bring it to your attention, but it will bring it to your attention in the context of where you've had security incidents, where you have your guarding deployments and guarding patrols, where you have your hardware positioned, where your cameras are, where your access control doors are. All of this data, all this richness of data that is available can now be contextualized for you in the context of 150 access denied events within your facilities. Realistically, who would not want to have access to that type of data? If you're in a decision-making position in security, many, many times in my previous role, I had to make decisions based on experience and intuition because I could not get access to the data or I didn't have time to analyze it.
If you want to learn more about how BeamUp is revolutionizing the security industry, visit beamup.ai. And you can email David at david@beamup.ai. Okay, let's get soft. Soft targets. Security professional Jenny Hesterman, PhD, is author of Soft Target Hardening, Protecting People from Attack, and a retired colonel from the U.S. Air Force. She has had lots of experience with secure facilities. Now, when she advises clients on soft targets, think schools, malls, convention centers, open air events, it's a whole nother story. You can protect against threat actors and terrorists, but Jenny, what about the regular Joe Blow doing something dumb, like say bringing a gun to the Super Bowl celebration here in my neck of the woods, Kansas City, and getting into an unplanned altercation with somebody else?
And it is usually going to be those regular stupidity, bad decisions, asymmetric kind of things that happen as opposed to an active shooter, right? And I think if you look last year, there were only 42 active shootings in the US. Now there were 630 mass shootings. The odds of being caught up in something like that are pretty slim, to be honest. So I think the Chiefs event was really interesting because it shows us how we need layered defense around an event, right? We need rings of security, layered defense. Like a lot of times when I go out and I do vulnerability assessments, the event or the building, they think security starts at the front door. And I have to tell them, like, you have to push it out. And it starts at the exterior ring, like the streets leading up to the event, the police presence, checking people, doing random bag checks, all the way up to the door, right? This is how we harden a base. Like at Andrews, we had Air Force One on the ramp, right? But I had rings of security, layers of security around it, all the way out into the community, on the internet. What are people saying about the event? Are they going to show up and protest? Things like that. So I think this just proves that we have to think in that layered defense mentality and start screening way out on the perimeter of these events instead of like right at the front door or right in there. We should expect the worst, right? We should anticipate. And an event like that, also, I don't know if a lot of people listening to this podcast realize, but there was a big conspiracy theory going on about the Kansas City Chiefs winning the Super Bowl. So there was an extremist opinion out there that the Chiefs actually won the game, that it was thrown by the other team. Anyway, understanding all that before an event happens and trying to figure out what actors may show up, who's going to come to this event and protest, or they're coming for a completely different reason. They're not celebrating the Chiefs win. They're there first because of some unhinged conspiracy theory that they believe. So knowing the environment and going online and seeing what people are saying about the event, the chatter about it, this is part of like the pre-planning process. It should be anyway.
Can I ask about, so those layers sound perfect. Like people think about, well, you have, you know, we've got tight security at the building. Mm-hmm. But then as you said, the layers of either information gathering in the moment or before out into the internet and the community and kind of the zeitgeist, mm-hmm. as well as physical layers on the streets and the blocks around. As a security professional, have you found when you're talking to clients who are going to have an event that is a soft target, or it's a particular location that lets the public in and out all the time and they have to think about this. Is it the ugliness and the worry that it will be off-putting to people that means they don't want to have layer after layer, or do they feel like it's not going to work? What's the pushback you get?
Well, there's quite a few things at play here. One is convenience, right? They want people to have a good experience, good fan experience. They paid a lot of money to go to a concert. They don't want them to feel like they're going into a Hymax prison or something. So there's that perspective. There's also just the whole sunk cost. It's expensive, right? To have those kinds of layers of defense and security and off-duty police officers on the perimeter and all these people. So sometimes when it comes to the expense of it, it's just too much. And so they harden right at the entrance. They figure that's the last place to make contact with the would-be bad actor. But then there's the mentality like, it's not going to happen here. It's not going to happen to me. Not going to happen today. I've heard all of that. Sometimes there's complacency. I did some consulting for a major center that is an NBA team's home base, and they have these games, you know, three times a week. They have concerts in between. They have hockey. All these things, it's a churn of it, right? And so the complacency, night after night, the same thing over and over. And so you can kind of let your guard down when that happens. The bad actors know that. I mean, they prey on that. They prey on complacency. They always try to, for instance, attack at the end of an event because they know we let our guard down, things like that. So we have to think in our security that we have to always fight complacency, fight the mentality it's not going to happen tonight, here, to me, and also think about the cost. When people say this is expensive, I say, what's the cost of not doing it? Let's think about that. And usually that kind of shifts their mindset.
So two questions, I'll ask both. You can choose which one to hit first. What is the payoff for customers to have a more obtrusive, layered security approach to a soft target? And then also, are there examples nationally or internationally of ways to make these layers of security look more pleasant and less offensive? And like you said, I don't want to feel like I'm walking into a Supermax when I go to a Taylor Swift concert.
Sure. Well, I'll use the example from the Middle East. So I lived in the Middle East for 2 years, from 2013 to 2015. This is where I got the idea to write the soft target hardening book, because I knew how to harden a base. I understood the mind of an actor, which was another part of my career that I spent time in, and also then saw in the Middle East how they harden soft targets. And it is this layered approach, right? It's this compound mentality. Our daughter went to high school there, and she went through metal detector, layers of security to get in. But once you're inside, you can really focus. I mean, she could really study. If you went to church, in this church compound that they had, you could focus on the sermon. You weren't looking behind you when a door opened, right? You could actually sink in and enjoy the experience. The same with hotels in the Middle East. You go through a lot of security, but once you were on the property, you could really enjoy your experience. So having lived that and then come back to the US where you're constantly on guard and you're always worried and you hear a loud noise and you panic, you know, just I think for the customer experience, the workers, the staff, whatever you're trying to protect, if you have that rings of security and layered defense and it is hardened, they're actually more productive. They're having a more enjoyable experience. If they're at a hospital, they're actually healing as opposed to worrying about someone. So that's the payoff. In terms of the ugliness of security, right? When I tell people that they
need... Yeah, prettier, less offensive.
Well, people, when I tell them they need more bollards, right, their eyes just glaze over because they think there's ugly. There's so many examples of beautiful security. I say security doesn't have to be ugly. It can be beautiful. I've taken photos from all over the world of beautiful bollards that are fountains and works of art, you know, and you don't even know what you're looking at, and it's actually security. So there's ways to make it pleasant. But I will say that people want to feel safe, right? They vote with their checkbook or with their wallet. And if they don't feel safe in an event, they're not going to go back. If their child, if they don't think their child's safe at a university, they're not going to send them there. So there's a payoff in terms of pulling people in. And I feel like people want to feel safe now. They want to feel secure. And so hiding security from them maybe is not the best idea either. So it's the balance. It's really a tough balance, which that article that we just did with ASIS really gets to the heart of.
Is there, my last question is about money. If maybe a hard target that has to have the security regularly, they have it locked in, they've got it budgeted for, and some of these open air events, oftentimes they're one-off or six times a year, or a place, like you said, a convention center, it's rotating so often, the cost of doing these layers or this slightly better security, it seems like a lot. Do you have any tips for security professionals who have to talk people into, this is different than what we normally do, or we're going to have to change the budget line item here because we need to just improve it?
There's ways to harden a facility or an event that aren't costly. Okay, so the first thing is, what do you say about the event? What is your language? That language is free. So when there's a 4th of July parade or some kind of a concert, what are you saying about security? Are you saying we will have bag checks? Nothing larger than a diaper bag allowed. We'd like to thank the local police for providing security. Because of bad actors, a lot of times are sizing up events. If they're not specifically targeting something, they're looking for the most vulnerable place to hit. They're looking at the same flyers and the same websites that you're looking at. So language is free, and that's something that they could do. And signage is another one. A lot of times with my vulnerability assessments, I see a lack of signage on the property to deter anybody from doing anything. It doesn't say this is private property, trespassers will be prosecuted, this area under camera surveillance, routine patrols. There's no indication that anything's happening there with security, and it might be, but because they haven't verbalized that or shown it in some way, they're making themselves a more inviting target. But again, with the cost, it does cost a lot, and sometimes these venues will pass that cost on to the customer, and it's hard for them because they think that fewer people will come. The problem is, or the benefit is, if you tell people we've added $2 to the ticket price to make sure this is a safe and secure event for you, that will pull people in. So I think just the mentality has to change that security is going to scare people away when it's actually going to pull them in.
And that is it for the latest episode of Security Management Highlights. Thanks to our sponsor, BeamUp at beamup.ai. And thanks to our guests, Mark Mullison, Jenny Hesterman, and David Harris. If you're interested in reading more about these topics, check out the links in the show notes. And if you got excited about something here, share this with your friends inside and outside of security management. The world needs to know how vital and awesome this field is. And leave us a review wherever you listen to this podcast. We would appreciate it. Find us at sm.asisonline.org. And hey, be safe out there.